You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Daniel Shore's NPR commentaries and analyses demonstrate a broad historical perspective, the product of his 6 decades in journalism. He's covered the administrations of 12 presidents and interviewed countless historical figures and won 3 Emmys along the way. His latest book, Come to Think of It, Notes on the Turn of the Millennium, is published by Viking, and it collects his thoughts on politics and American life from 1990 to the present. It is my pleasure to welcome him back to the show. Hello.
My pleasure.
What was your first job in journalism? Can you tell us the story of how you didn't become a music critic?
Oh, yes, I can tell you that story. It's a typically New York story, too. I liked music. I played an instrument, and I was very interested in journalism and tried to combine the two. And so I got part-time work at the New York Times doing occasional criticisms of music. The great, well-known critic of the New York Times was named Olin Downs at the time. I don't know if that name means anything here anymore, but he was the great critic. I did an article for the Times that interested him, and he called me and said, "Will you come in and talk to me a little bit about these composers you're writing about?" Sure. So in the subway, on the way down to see him the next morning, I was reading the New York Times, and there was a review by Olin Downs of a concert of the New York Philharmonic the previous evening with Joseph Tsigeti as the violin soloist. He writes, Downs writes, his tone, as usual, was impeccable, but the profile of the tone left something to be desired. I looked at that and said, "Now, what the hell does that mean?" I mean, I thought I knew a little bit about music. So when I saw Downs, when we finished the conversation that he wanted, I said, "Could I ask you a question? Here where it says about Tsigeti and the profile, what does that mean?" He said, "Mr. Shore, don't worry about it. That's bull. That's the kind of thing you write when you're on deadline trying to fill a couple of paragraphs." That turned me off on being a music critic.
But it didn't turn you off on journalism.
Oh, no.
Other than the fact that TV has come to dominate the media, how has journalism changed since you started out in the 40s?
Yes, journalism is changing. Now, of course, looking at it from my vantage point of 91 years and having done almost every kind of journalism there is, starting as a newspaper man, then radio and then television, and now back to radio, I think I've done almost everything except that while I was getting old, there were new ways of purveying news that were arising, thanks in large part to the Internet. And we now live in an age where I tune on the Internet, I punch the Internet in, and I find that we're dealing today with bloggers who are complete journalists in themselves. That is to say that the blogger is his own reporter, his or her own reporter, his own editor, his own publisher, his own everything. I, being old, think there has to be a discipline in journalism, that everybody has to be edited for grammar, for spelling, for everything else. And so I'm a little unhappy about the way things are going. At the same time, the economics of journalism are becoming very tough. Newspapers are beginning to lose circulation. They can't count on the kind of advertising revenue. Television stations, these television networks, are all in the hands of people looking at the bottom line and no longer as interested as my one-time boss, Bill Paley at CBS, was. And so somewhere between the economics of journalism, which makes it rather difficult, I find myself a little distressed.
But you're back in radio, which many people predicted would die. Radio
That's right.
seems to be doing thriving while the things that replaced it are not doing as well, except the Internet, of course.
In 1953, when I joined CBS, Frank Stanton, who was the president of CBS, said to me, "Welcome aboard. You may do radio for a while, But we don't think that radio networks have any future because advertising on television costs so much and leaves them. Was he ever wrong? I mean, there have been several renaissances of radio. And for me, radio is the most marvelous thing. At my age, I don't get around very easily. I don't really care to put on makeup anymore. I don't want to go stand on a street corner looking into a camera just because it's better than sitting in a studio. Radio, for me, keeps me going.
Well, it also allows you to do some kind of reasoned analysis without somebody pressuring you to speak faster.
Oh, but absolutely. I mean,
on TV, they'd be snapping your fingers. Daniel, get this whole thing out in 10 seconds.
You're absolutely right. And I have a wonderful arrangement with National Public Radio. I write analysis. They call me their senior news analyst. Senior, I guess, means old. On any given day, I can go through the day thinking about what's going on, call in and say, you know, I think I'm going to analyze this or analyze that. They're very receptive. There is editing. I do make mistakes still of getting a first name wrong or something like that. But it's marvelous. And it gives me what I think at my age is the best thing I can do for the outside world. That is to take all the stuff that gets given to them in the form of news and try to tell them what it means. Meaning is a word that's become very important to me.
And it's important to you for it to be called analysis and not commentary.
And sorry?
You'd prefer the word analysis to commentary.
Oh, yes. Don't ask me why. These are all very small matters. Commentary gives me, if I were to call it commentary, it would make me very opinionated. Analysis, I like to consider myself as analytical rather than opinionated. There are people who disagree with me.
Well, there are people who would perceive some kind of opinion in your analysis. Didn't you help Ted Turner create CNN? What do you think of the way it's evolved?
Yes, that was interesting. I had left CBS in a row with CBS about editorial independence. I had left CBS, was looking for a job, and all of a sudden got a call from Ted Turner, whom I didn't know very much about. I'm talking about now, this is all somewhere in 1979. And he said, Dan Shore, I want to offer you a job. I said, oh, yes? Doing what? He says, well, come to Las Vegas where I'm meeting with the cable industry, and I can tell you in more detail. But what it basically is, I want to start a 24-hour-a-day news service on cable television. I hardly knew what cable television was, and I went out and talked to him. I still wasn't sure, but the money was right, and it seemed right, and so I went to work. I was the first employee of Ted Turner's cable news network, and stayed with him 5-6 years and left.
It's become more politicized, hasn't it? I saw Ralph Reed serving as an analyst of the New Hampshire primaries on CNN. Is someone as partisan and compromised because of his connection with Jack Abramoff an appropriate person to provide commentary?
Well, what's happened is now CNN has to compete with Fox 5, and they're trying to find out what will interest people, and they find that crime, scandal, sex of one sort or another seems to sell well. And so you're getting an awful lot of things which maybe you and I would not consider to be important to the world, but which are interesting. Kidnapped children, O.J. Simpson in trouble again, and so on. That is the stuff of which cable television is made.
But when you have somebody who's partisan, now it's different than, I think,
partisanship
giving Oliver North or G. Gordon Liddy a talk show, because those are expected to be opinion mediums.
You're right, and I don't think that CNN overdoes it too much, but it is true. Sometimes it's simply the reporter covering a something in a campaign gets swept up in it. And they tend to become advocates of the people they are covering. That's something which, in my youth, I used to watch for very carefully. Don't become wedded to the person that you've been sent to watch.
But objectivity, of course, is a concern of all journalists, and there is a big debate over whether it's even possible to be objective.
Well, that's a good question. Whether objectivity is something you strive for and sometimes almost reach and sometimes don't quite reach.
You've also said in a speech a few years back that journalists are innately pessimistic. So does that color the way they approach stories?
I'm afraid that's true. For some reason, bad news gets more audience than good news. And, you know, some big scandal in the White House, a lot of people in trouble, people may be going to jail. It's much more fun to report on for the average journalist, including me at an earlier age, than the news about here's a wonderful thing. Now, they are catching wise to that. Like CBS, for example, has a weekly feature on the evening news, a weekly feature on something very interesting and nice that happened. In America. And I think they're beginning to come back a little bit and realize they cannot be totally negative.
Do you ever question the way NPR handles news stories? Because, you know, there are many people who see NPR as a liberal news service and others as the radio service for the earnest crowd. They'll say, you know, the audience was filled with NPR types.
NPR gets a fair share of mail criticizing, but also a lot of letters praising them. I mean, if you allow yourself to be discouraged because you get four or five emails saying you were wrong about this and how dare you and why you're being so mean to our president and so on, but I think that they're somewhat matched by letters from people who think that you're doing just fine. I myself, if I thought differently, I would say so, but I myself think that NPR does pretty well.
That those letters change over time. In the early years of the Bush administration, whenever anyone came on the show and was critical of the president, I would get those letters. I don't get those letters anymore. Perhaps the tone of the country is changed.
But I like to look at this from the other point of view. You're looking at it from the point of view of the journalist. I'm looking at it from the point of view of the newsmaker, that is the president and so on. And more, they've come to manipulate the press. For example, they're much more likely to give interviews to Fox 5 than to one of the other networks. They know they'll be well treated. And they're very careful. They determine the seating at the press conferences. The president has a chart and knows whom he's calling on. He knows, has been briefed on whether this is going to be a nice question, maybe not a nice question, and all of that. Instead of examining us all the time, I would like to spend some time examining the ways in which government and government leaders have learned to manipulate the media.
So that has changed. Kennedy wouldn't have understood that?
Kennedy did.
Because he was a darling of the media.
But he did it rather quite openly. Yes, it is true. Kennedy had his friends, and his friends got better treatment than those who weren't his friends. I was at one point, and I considered to be a friend of his, because reporting from Germany reported that the Germans were very unhappy with him, with the result that when he came to Germany, he met me and said, "You know, how are you doing, Dan? Are you making any mischief?" and so on.
Wasn't as bad as putting you on an enemies list, which we will get to later. Daniel Schorr is currently a senior news analyst for NPR. He's won 3 Emmys, decorations from European heads of state, a Peabody Award for a lifetime of uncompromising reporting of the highest integrity. And he's also won an Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Golden Baton for exceptional contributions to radio and television reporting and commentary. He has written a new book called Come to Think of It, Notes on the Turn of the Millennium. It is published by Viking, and we will continue our conversation after this. Daniel Schorr's latest book is called Come to Think of It, Notes on the Turn of the Millennium, commentaries from senior news analyst at National Public Radio. The book is published by Viking. You mentioned earlier that you you went to CNN after you had some problems at CBS.
Yes.
That actually resonated later. The whole issue resonated later with the Judith Miller incident.
Right.
You had been asked to disclose a source in 1976, and you didn't want to do it?
That's right. In 1976, the House Intelligence Committee had done an investigation of CIA misdeeds in previous years and written a report of about 130 pages, which you were on the verge of making public. The administration didn't like it and managed to get the House of Representatives to suppress the report. As it happened, however, I had a draft copy of it and faced myself an ethical problem. If the House wants to sit on this, but I have a copy of it, what is my duty? Didn't take me long to say my duty is to make it available to a wider public. And I did that. And they got a lot of people very angry. The CIA was mad at me, the Ford administration. And even CBS was very uncomfortable because a lot of local stations were complaining that I was doing unpatriotic things. In the end, the House Ethics Committee launched an investigation of how the report had leaked and, unable to find out, subpoenaed me and demanded to know where I got it. It was an early Judith Miller kind of thing because this was a confidential source whom I was not going to betray. And so they had me at a public hearing and several times lectured me and in the end said, if you refuse to give us this information, you may be declared in contempt of Congress, which might mean 2 years in jail and a $100,000 fine. I don't have those figures straight because I don't remember them. All the same, very nervous because I thought that could easily happen. I really didn't feel like going to jail, but I had no way out. And I just said that for a reporter to reveal a source is, for me, not just something I say I can do. I viscerally am unable to do that, so you'll have to do what you want to do. And in the end, because my appearance had been on television and some people liked my appearance, they put some pressure on, and the committee went out to vote and came back. They had voted 6-5 not to cite me for contempt. I was very relieved.
But then CBS was still unhappy with you, and that led you to leave?
CBS had been unhappy with me. At this point, however, CBS was getting to be happier with me than it had been for a long time. Because why? Because my ratings had gone up in the meantime. But too much had passed between CBS and me, and they asked me to come back, and I said, I think it's all over, and I left.
But when the Judith Miller incident occurred, did you feel total sympathy toward her, or did you see differences in the circumstances? Because she, although she hadn't been you, she hadn't even published the thing. That was where somebody in the administration was trying to hurt somebody else and use reporters to do that.
Well, that's right. But we went through all that week after week back when it happened. To answer your question, do I have sympathy with Judith Miller? I have sympathy with Judith Miller. I have also lots of criticism of Judy Miller. I didn't like her reporting on Iraq, which turned out to be all wrong, there were various other things. And maybe she shouldn't have accepted that confidence with regard to the CIA person who had been named when it was supposed to be undercover. But in the end, it comes down to the final thing. You've taken the information, you've told the source, so you will protect that source. If you then, in spite of that, because somebody is threatening you or pressuring you, you would betray that source, what you're really doing is drying up many, many sources for many, many future journalists. And that's what's involved there. For me, it's not a matter of me alone. It is, if some people, well, Dan Short gave his source, why shouldn't you? I could not allow that to be. So, yes, in the end, my sympathy lay with Judy Miller.
So how do you deal with issues like that when it is also important to find out who broke a law? Or do we just simply say, okay, the reporter is not going to reveal the source and that's the end of this?
Yes. I wish that were the end, but it seldom is the end. There is a Supreme Court decision on this matter with reporters, two reporters way back, about 15, 20 years ago, where the Supreme Court held, and that's been the rule ever since, held that while it may be important for a journalist to protect the source, and maybe that serves some purpose for people to get to know better, still, that if a prosecution, if a grand jury, if a district attorney needs the information in pursuit of a criminal inquiry, that takes precedence. And that's the Supreme Court word on the subject, which doesn't make me happy, but that's it.
You also, the government does have a way of getting back at reporters it doesn't like. You were subject to a tax audit in 1973 because of your coverage of Watergate.
That's true.
You discovered you were on the enemies list?
True. Nixon had something about me. By the way, yesterday would have been Nixon's birthday, by the way.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Richard, wherever you are. Where were we?
I was talking about the tax audit, the way the government tax, can also get back at reporters,
right.
other than throwing them in jail.
It went like this. It's a long story, which I'll try to shorten because you may have other things you want to ask. The problem that arose was that I had done a critical commentary about a Nixon program on the CBS Evening News. As I later learned, did not know then, they had a meeting and said, let's get this guy. And word was given to call J. Edgar Hoover and say, get some dirt on him. Something went wrong between the White House and the FBI because Hoover seems to have misunderstood what was wanted. They told him they wanted some background on Dan Shore, and background to the FBI is a very, very special word that means checking out somebody preparatory to offering him a White House job. And so because FBI misunderstood, they thought that was it. It turned out that wasn't it. They called off the investigation and then had to figure out what to do, as inevitably the newspapers would want to know about this. And they decided the only thing they could say was that I was being considered for an appointment, but they had forgotten to tell me that. Which, however crazy it was, Ron Ziegler, the press spokesman, came out and said that. Well, that there was also the fact that I was on the top 20 in the enemies list, ahead of Paul Newman, if you can believe that, just ahead of Paul Newman. And so, in general, there were big problems between Nixon administration and me. 20 years later, Nixon out of office, he's resigned, he's been forced to resign, and 20 years later, I am at a dinner party with Nixon, where he's giving a report on a recent trip to the Soviet Union. And I could not resist going up to him after the dinner and saying, Mr. Nixon, I'm not sure you'll remember me, but... And he put a hand on my shoulder and he said, sure, Dan, sure, glad to see you. Damn near hired you once. Those were my last words with Nixon.
Daniel Schor's latest book is called Come to Think of It, Notes on the Turn of the Millennium. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. These are commentaries that you started, analyses.
Thank you.
They go back to 1991.
Right.
In going over all of the, I guess you've saved all of them, or you have air checks of all of them.
Yes, we have. It's all. I keep my own scripts, and all the recording of it is in the archives at NPR. So it is really possible to get almost anything I've ever done for NPR. It's really quite remarkable too.
I'm assuming that these are all ones that you're proud of or that discuss issues. But I suspect there are a few that you'd probably like to have erased from the archives.
Well, since you ask, I'm willing to acknowledge the following, that when we arranged the Vikings, that people said, just give us all your scripts and we'll make a selection. We can't use them all, but we'll make a selection. I said, okay, you make the selection. And I said, can I ask you one thing? If there are a few in which I was really dead wrong, could you please select something else? And that was considered to be a joke. But I'm not aware offhand, as I think back over it, of any that I really need to be completely ashamed of.
Well, because your analysis doesn't work that way. There is a kind of an overview. You're not the kind of guy who predicts, that so-and-so
right.
is going to win this primary.
No, that's right. No, that's right.
You don't function as a pundit.
I don't predict, and I try not to be a pundit. And I try to say, this is the way this thing falls into place and looks to me. I'm trying to give them a sense of how things relate to other things. I said, I will not lead them to believe that I know something which I don't know, that I have inside knowledge which I don't have. Most of my work is done by simply reading, phoning some people, and thinking. Thinking is a much neglected thing in journalism.
Well, we see so often what we see in coverage of the primaries and things of that sort is people explaining why things didn't go the way they predicted, and somehow not blaming themselves for being part of the problem.
You are referring, of course, to the what happened in New Hampshire.
Although the mea culpa seemed to be rather shocking in the light of the fact that Barack Obama wound up with as many delegates as Hillary Clinton.
But that's not the point. The point is that nine different polling organizations came up with more or less the same conclusion. And that was that Obama would have a 5 to 10 point lead over Hillary Clinton, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were all wrong. They're very busy investigating why they were wrong. One of the reasons they were wrong, apparently, is that because nobody likes to work over weekends, the polling ended before the weekend. And it appears a lot of people changed their minds or undecided, made up their minds over the weekend. That's happened before. By the way, that New Hampshire is wrong because they closed shop too early. They should have gone on tracking polling right through Sunday and Monday as well. They didn't do that, and now they pay a heavy price in whether people can believe them.
Well, the real issue here is whether the polls should matter anyway. If the polls are predicting that one candidate is going to win, does that influence voters? Or is that simply part of this whole horse race
process? It can. I remember when, for example, in the presidential election, the polling, they based on exit polls, they gave the result of the election and what it was going to be, although the polls were still open on the West Coast. And there was a big outcry about, don't steal our election from us. When people hear that it's all decided, they don't go to vote. And the result was that that polling organization and the networks have been forced to promise that they will not give exit poll results from any place until the polls have closed in that place, which I think is a good idea.
Yesterday on NPR's All Things Considered, you said that the economy is beginning to be a bigger issue for voters than the war in Iraq.
Yes.
If we slide into a recession, as some economists are predicting, won't it make it a lot harder for the next president to get anything done in Washington?
No.
Because it'll wind up, it's the economy, stupid, and there is still that war in Iraq. And
there's still the war in Iraq, but the economy is stupid is for the purpose of the campaign, and once you get a president there, he's going to have to really sit down. It isn't really all that easy to end a recession, and he'll just have to deal with it. But we're not talking about what people do when they become president. We only talk about what they do when they're candidates, because that may not have much connection with what they later do.
Well, for example, presidents have promised real health care reform, and we haven't seen it. Bush ran on the idea of privatization of Social Security.
Right.
That's dead, isn't it?
That is dead, yes. That's what's called the third rail of politics. You stop fooling around Social Security, you get all kinds of people against you. The privatization, I think, is dead is the word.
Although there's plenty of other privatization that continues in government these days. You said that in the book that the United States turned Iraq into a new source of terrorist threat by invading it. Could that have been avoided other than by not invading Iraq?
Well, it could have been avoided by not invading Iraq. I mean, that was the big scam of a century pulled on the American people by an administration which should have if it didn't know better. I mean, this was a group of ideologues, neoconservatives, who came into office with President Bush. They wanted to dismantle the government some. They wanted to establish who runs things in the Middle East. They liked the idea of unilateral military action. And in order to justify it, they said, oh, we're going to have to do something about Iraq, but Iraq is supporting Osama bin Laden and all those terrorists. There was not an iota of evidence that that was true. And yet, there's on the basis of that gross untruth, they invaded a country, costing this nation around $1 trillion so far, not to mention lives.
You've said that flip-flopping is a political form of gotcha. Are accusations of flip-flopping ever meaningful?
Well, the trouble with the accusation of flip-flopping is that it's almost for almost any candidate, he must at some point, as events change his positions. And almost anyone, if you go and do a lot of research, you will find in almost every case that way back when he was a freshman congressman, so no, he did that. It's an unhappy thing in our politics, and it's largely now thanks to Google and all these other ways of searching, you can get a lot of information out of a machine, and you can come across something with sound. For example, the thing that Hillary was having a lot of trouble with the question of supporting the resolution on the war. First of all, they talk about its resolution without understanding the resolution or forgetting what it was. The resolution called for diplomatic efforts to try to solve the problem of weapons in Iraq. And if that did not succeed, then one would have to consider use of force. Well, the fact of the matter was, it was succeeding in the sense that inspectors were going in and inspections weren't finished. And so if you're a senator and you're being asked, you don't want to tie the president's hands, he's going to go in and do a lot of diplomacy, it's very difficult if, as a patriot to say, I'm not going to support that. It takes kind of a certain kind of guts, and it's very difficult to do. And with Johnson and the Bay of Tonkin Gulf Resolution, all those are presidents say, I need to have my hands free in case. And Congress can hardly say, we don't want you to have your hands free in case. And so there we are.
Well, the big issues in this election seem to be taxes, health care, the war in Iraq.
Yes.
The economy, the environment has been discussed a lot. And yet
it's beginning to come in.
Do you think it's actually going to sway a voter or two?
I don't know. You're asking me to make predictions.
but just taking the pulse of the country, it seems to me that Al Gore talked a lot about it, won an Oscar for a film about it, and yet if he were running for president, that couldn't get him elected.
You think?
Well, I'm not so sure. I don't think it's the issue that grabs people, and I wonder why.
Knowing now what we know about the past 7 years, if the election were held today, but with knowledge of what 7 years of Bush would be, I think almost anybody would, including Gore, could win.
Well, Gore did win, but that's
Gore,
a whole other...
that's a whole other story, yes.
And that's another commentary, and I thank you so much for being with us again today, Daniel Schorr. His latest book, Come to Think of It, Notes on the Turn of the Millennium, published by Viking. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you.